Hello and welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My name's Craig Barker and I'm the Head of Public Engagement for the museum. In this podcast series, we explore a guest's relationship with one of the items or a series of items in the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection. For this particular episode, I'm really, really excited to be joined by a colleague of mine at the University of Sydney, Dr. Natalie Pearson. Natalie is a critical heritage studies scholar working at the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre here at the University of Sydney and specialises in maritime heritage within Southeastern Asia. Natalie is also the host of the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre's podcast as well, so I'm going to have to pull up my socks. Natalie, welcome.
Hi, Craig. Thanks for the free plug for SEAC Stories.
It's a great podcast. I really enjoy listening to it, and I'm encouraging anyone listening here to don't press stop just yet. Wait till the end of the episode, but go and have a listen. Some of the episodes are fantastic. So it's great to have you along, and I've been wanting to get you on for some time. Could I begin by asking you about your personal background and your research interests?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. So I'm an academic here at the University of Sydney at the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre, and my research is affiliated with the discipline of archaeology. I've also got close connections with Asian studies. And I guess I like to think of my research as like a Venn diagram of the ocean, heritage and Southeast Asia. So where those three circles meet, that's kind of where I'm doing my work. It makes a lot of sense to me because Southeast Asia is very archipelagic, maritime Southeast Asia. It's full of shipwrecks and amazing underwater cultural heritage. And so my research focuses on this part of the world. I have a background in Asian studies, in Indonesian and history. I wrote my honours thesis on material culture in Timor-Leste at a time when it was becoming independent and demonstrating its identity on the world stage through its textiles and ties.
Yeah.
That led to the Department of Defence recruiting me because I was somebody who knew something about Timor-Leste back in 2002, 2003.
So not long after the Australian
Interfet, that's right. So I spent a few years working in industry, working for the federal government at Defence and at AUSTRAC, the Anti-Money Laundering Counterterrorism Financing Regulator. At that time, I did a Masters of Strategic and Policy Studies. Then I went on to do a Masters of Museum Studies through University of Sydney. And then I did my PhD in Museum and Heritage Studies here at the University of Sydney as well. So it's lots of degrees under my belt, lots of diverse degrees and lots of industry experience as well.
Well, I'm pleased you took us through that journey because A, it's exhausting. I don't know how you've done it all. But B, it really emphasises your interest in interdisciplinarity, and of course that's a key focus of your work at the university, but also obviously a key focus of the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre. How do you see, I mean, A, how do you juggle it all, but how do you see that as significant in terms of both research and also student engagement, dealing with our very close neighbours to Australia, but on a whole range of different perspectives, historical, political, cultural?
Look, I might use that as an opportunity to share a little bit more about what the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre does. Because even though my research, I'm affiliated with archaeology and I'm looking at maritime heritage, through my work at SEAC, I am very influenced by all the other disciplines that we are exposed to through the course of the centre's work. So I often describe myself as geography curious, but I do a lot of work with sociologists, political scientists, and then through our work at the centre, you know, we're working with academics and students from across the university. We're a multidisciplinary centre, and I like to describe us as a benign growth on the on the side of the faculties and schools, connecting everybody interested in Southeast Asia. So we've got about 400 academic members at the university and about 200 postgraduate members. And the thing that connects all of us is Southeast Asia. And, you know, it's absolutely wonderful to be exposed to these other disciplinary perspectives in terms of methods, how they frame their research questions. I learn a lot through, you know, the exposure to all these many different disciplines. In terms of my work at the centre, my focus is mostly on student engagement and community building.
Yep, yep.
So I have what I think is the best job in the world. I get to run the field schools to Southeast Asia.
Yes, and these have been extraordinary.
Yeah, they're multidisciplinary. We always try and have a minimum of three different faculties involved. So, for example, arts and social sciences, engineering and architecture to go and look at something like disaster risk and resilience in the Philippines. A recent one was on disability and work in Timor Timor-Leste with students from social work, psychology and occupational therapy.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're learning about Southeast Asia, but approaching it through this particular lens of, for example, disability and work. And it's such a great way to learn more about the region and get students really engaged.
But also not just students engaging with the region, but also engaging with each other across faculty that they wouldn't get to meet one another.
Absolutely.
Otherwise.
Well, the psychology students, for example, in the Timor-Leste Field School, their cohort is 600 students strong.
Yeah.
And they didn't know each other when they arrived in Dili.
Yeah.
And after the Timor Field School, we received a photo of the three of them sitting together in their lecture. And they're now, of course, fast friends. Yeah. So this concept of Southeast Asia, this idea of Southeast Asia, is such a powerful way of connecting people across the university. We have so many skills and experts in this area, but all coming from different disciplinary backgrounds and perspectives.
And obviously in terms of future leadership, such an important role for Australia to build those relationships with our close neighbours that we have historically either ignored or have mistreated or have not necessarily been the best neighbours. So, you know, to actually create that culture of understanding and amongst the student body.
Well, there's been some really interesting work done about the impact of, for example, the mobility programs, not just on the students who, the Australian students who go, who are, you know, supported to do so through the New Colombo Plan, but in terms of the communities that they impact when they travel as well and the benefits for the people that they work with in country.
Yeah.
And when they return, a lot of these students, these Australian students, talk about, you know, these public diplomacy aspects that come about as a result of participating in a mobility program where, you know, if they've been to Indonesia, say, which is where I do most of my research, they come back to Australia and they are pushing back against anti-Islamic sentiment. They are keeping an eye out for any Indonesians on the train or on campus and making that extra effort because they've been exposed to the new ideas, you know, the diverse cultures. Our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has just released his new Southeast Asia Economic Engagement Strategy. It really is an important part of the world, and it is such a privilege to take the students to the region and get them excited and involved and to learn more about the relationship between Australia and Southeast Asia. You know, it is the future.
Yeah. Now, as if you're not already busy enough, you're also quite heavily involved in ICOMOS Indonesia. So what does that work involve?
So, yeah, I am a member of ICOMOS. ICOMOS is the International Council of Monuments and Sites. And I became a member only fairly recently, actually. And I'm part of the International Scientific Committee on Archaeological Heritage Management. And I'm a member of the inaugural Working Group on Illicit Trafficking. And this brings in my experience at AUSTRAC, which I mentioned at the beginning, in anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing. When I first started my PhD research, you know, the research question I had in mind was around the illicit trafficking of antiquities, in my case, out of Indonesia, but of course we see it happening in other parts of the world, like Syria, for example, and how antiquities are used to move value across borders.
Yes.
So it's a really big issue. There's been a lot of attention being paid to it in the Middle East in recent, you know, the past decade or so. But I'm interested in asking these questions about illicit trafficking in the context of Southeast Asia and in particular in underwater cultural heritage, which not many people are, you know, connecting those dots at this stage.
Yes,
it's very hard to find out information about this because it is, by its nature, concealed. So ICOMOS has been, you know, has established this working group on illicit trafficking. I'm also president of the Indonesia Council, which is a sub-regional body of the Asian Studies Association of Australia. So we connect Indonesia-focused researchers from Australia and Indonesia. And then I'm also a counsellor for the Australasian Institute for Maritime Archaeology. So I've got these diverse service and engagement commitments, I suppose you would call them as an academic, but they reflect my diverse interests, right? And I feel like I'm always trying to get the Indonesianists to think about heritage.
Yep.
I'm always trying to get the heritage scholars to think about the ocean.
Yep.
And I'm always trying to get maritime scholars to think about Southeast Asia. So my pitch depends on my audience.
Well, can I segue that in that case into maritime archaeology, which is one of your great passions and you've got that background in it. I guess, you know, most of our listeners have got a pretty good handle on what terrestrial archaeology is, but maritime archaeology, particularly in the 21st century where there's been quite a lot of leaps in terms of technology, but also a lot of leaps in terms of things like the ethics and greater cultural and legal understanding of rights and responsibilities. What is maritime archaeology in the 21st century? And where are some of the places you've actually worked?
So I describe myself as a critical heritage studies scholar. I use the wonderful data that my maritime archaeology friends collect and analyse, but I don't describe myself as a maritime archaeologist. When we think about what maritime archaeology is, there has been a debate, you know, is it a sub-discipline of archaeology? Is it a separate discipline? I consider it part of archaeology. Yeah. And it is, in its most basic form, the study of material culture related to human interaction with the sea. I also want to expand on that to include rivers and lakes.
Yes,
some of my colleagues are doing wonderful research on rivers and lakes, so let's not leave them out when we're thinking about maritime archaeology.
Not to mention submerged ground surface.
Absolutely. Submerged cultural landscapes is a huge feature of maritime archaeology in Australia at the moment, looking at Indigenous sites around the Western Australian coast. But it also involves things like, of course, the study of ships and shipwrecks, maritime infrastructure, maritime cultural landscapes, fish weirs, shipwreck survivor camps. Mm. So it doesn't have to be a wet site. It can be a dry site. Right. And even things like Indigenous knowledge systems relating to how you harness the winds and the tides and the currents and how that is represented in material form through the design of boats, for example. Yeah. So thinking about the connection between, intangible and tangible.
Yeah, fascinating. Now, you have relatively recently published a book on perhaps the most famous shipwreck site in Southeast Asia, the Beltong?
Yeah,
I'm going to have to do that again, aren't I?
So it's pronounced Blitung.
Blitung.
But it's spelt Belitung, and often that is how it's pronounced. But actually, Blitung is the name of the island where the shipwreck was found in Indonesia, just off the east coast of Sumatra, and it's where BHP first set up shop.
So if you think of this before, this is extraordinary.
Yeah, if you think of Blitung BHP, Blitung kind of sounds like Billiton. So
your book Blitung, The Afterlife of a Shipwreck, published this year. Could you talk a bit more about this particular shipwreck site and then what drew you to actually write about it?
So, this is one of the most marvellous shipwreck discoveries. I think probably every shipwreck discovery is quite marvellous. But, when I first started my PhD research, I was interested in the illicit trafficking of heritage out of Indonesia. And I, of course, as a junior researcher, just thought of Borobudur and the theft of Buddha heads from that enormous Buddhist monument in central Java. And there's a lot of work that could have been done on that. But my supervisor, Adrian Vickers, who's a faculty member here at University of Sydney, said to me, Natalie, there's a shipwreck in Singapore. Why don't you look at that? And maybe you could do a comparative analysis of the trade in cultural heritage from Indonesia. Yep. And first question was, why is the shipwreck in Singapore, not Indonesia?
Yep.
Anyway, I went off to Singapore to look at the wreck, all the objects recovered from the wreck. And I was one of those students who changed my research topic. So I ditched Borobudur and I left that to the terrestrial experts. And I realised that the shipwreck really did bring together my interest in ocean heritage and Southeast Asia. So it's a very significant wreck. It dates to the 9th century. It is a Western Indian ocean style vessel, which means that it was made by lashing, sewing the planks together.
Okay.
Not a single nail or dowel was used in its construction.
Right, yes.
The crew lived, there was no deck, so the crew lived on top of the cargo on bamboo mats, and they lived and toileted and cooked on top of the objects that it contained. And
but it was designed for ocean going.
Absolutely, And it was carrying up to 70,000 Tang Dynasty ceramics and other objects. I mean, the bulk of the cargo was ceramic. There were a few objects of gold, silver, bronze, some coins, which helped in dating it to the 9th century, but the vast majority, and that's what made this shipwreck so interesting from an art historical and historical perspective, is that it was like a floating IKEA, as one docent described it to me, because it was full of these multi-duplicate ceramics. And they're not even, the blue and white that everybody loves, they're these sort of small brown bowls that look like you might eat your breakfast in there. You can imagine holding them in your hand. And I've come to find them very beautiful. They have these gorgeous designs. And, it was a significant discovery in terms of what it told us about early globalization. It was connecting China. It was found in Indonesian waters. The objects are believed to have been destined for the Middle East. So, it was telling us about early globalization and maritime
mass
trade.
Mass production as well.
And mass production, what the Chinese kilns were capable of producing in a short amount of time, raising really fascinating questions about mobilization of labor and relationship with the agricultural calendar and the seasons, raising questions about the monsoon and how you get you know, 50,000 bowls from central China along the canal system to a port where they can be picked up.
Yes.
Lots of questions about the trade routes and why this ship was found so far south of the principal trading route in the Malacca Strait. And I go into a lot of this in my book, but actually the thing that really grabbed my attention with the Belitung shipwreck was the controversy around it.
Yes.
So when it was discovered in 1998 in Indonesian waters, you know, President Suharto had just fallen from power. There was a lot of upheaval in Indonesia at the time, a lot of anti-Chinese sentiment, and here was a shipwreck full of Chinese cargo.
Yes.
And it was legal in Indonesia at that time to apply for a commercial survey and salvage permit. And that is what the commercial salvagers did. And they obtained the permit. They recovered the objects, desalinated them, exported them to New Zealand for conservation over many years. And they began this extensive marketing campaign.
Yes.
So under the international standards, the way you manage underwater cultural heritage is to scientifically excavate it in accordance with maritime archaeology principles. But this was quite a different model where the objects were recovered quickly and were being sold for profit. So it was legal, but was it ethical?
Yeah.
So Singapore purchased the objects. This is how the...
so that's why they're there.
This is how they ended up at the Asian Civilizations Museum in Singapore. Singapore bought them for $32 million. Seemed like a lot of money back then, but I think now the consensus is Singapore got itself a bargain.
Yeah.
So Singapore embarked on this huge international exhibition, beautiful glossy catalogue produced with the Smithsonian Institution.
Yes, yeah.
The exhibition opened in Singapore in 2011. It was scheduled to go to Washington at the Smithsonian, and just 5 months before it was due to open in Washington, the Smithsonian cancelled it, raising concerns that it was too close to treasure hunting. Commercial salvage and treasure hunting were not in accordance with the international standards.
Yeah.
So it created a huge controversy, and that is a great topic for a PhD research thesis, then turning it into a book. Yeah.
And the book's available now.
It is. It's published through University of Hawaii Press in Northern America, and it's just come out with NUS Press in Southeast Asia.
Well done. Congratulations.
Thanks for the plug.
Well, look, object matters. We do need to talk about an object from the collection. And in many ways you've chosen something I didn't expect you to, but also in many ways it's something which is so obvious given the conversation we've just had. What object have you chosen from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection for us to discuss today?
I have chosen, look, the Southeast Asia element of the Chow Chak Wing Museum's collection is not a collection strength.
No.
There are some objects from Southeast Asia and great research potential there.
Yes.
But I haven't chosen something from Southeast Asia at all. No. I have chosen a transport amphora typical of the Greco-Italic type. So I'm not...
We're in the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
In my neck of the water.
Well, thank goodness you're here to help me. Because, as I said, the Mediterranean is not my area of expertise, Southeast Asia is. Yeah. But the thing that attracted me to this object was that it has been underwater.
Yeah. And I guess many of the principles are applicable irrespective of where in the globe you're looking in terms of underwater maritime culture. But this particular amphora, could you describe it for our listeners?
So the thing that really stood out to me about this amphora is that it is encrusted with oyster shells and marine matter all over the surface. And what I wanted to explore in our discussion is its experience while it was underwater. So this is a human-made technology as part of Roman trade used to transport and store different substances and liquids like wine or oil and fish sauce. And it's been discovered at some point, and it's been donated to Chow Chak Wing Museum through the Nicholson Collection.
Yeah.
But what about the time it spent underwater? How did it come to be so encrusted?
Yeah.
That's what has attracted me to it.
And I think from a museum perspective, one of the interesting things is it still has that incrustation on it, because so many of us have been to museums around the globe and we've seen material recovered from water or underwater, and it's been cleaned up as part of the conservation and presentation process. But this actually gives an indication of maritime archaeology in the broader sense, doesn't it?
That is a great point. I recently read a really interesting research paper about how concretions and incrustations are softened off objects, heated and softened, so that they can be removed from the ceramics.
Yeah.
This is in the context of China's maritime archaeological displays, so that these incrustations can be removed and the object restored to a more pristine, pure version of its original self. But I have lots of questions about that. Like, why do we want to restore the object to what it looked like in this case 2,000 years ago?
Yeah.
This object has been left encrusted, but at the Asian Civilizations Museum where Belitung is displayed, there is a wonderful example of some of the bowls, some of the storage jars that have been cleaned, some of them look brand new. They look lustrous and their glaze looks like it was just applied yesterday.
Yes.
And then there are others that have clearly spent time underwater. They have, you know, shells attached to them or coral or encrustations in some form. Mm. And actually, in the antique markets of Jakarta, where shipwreck objects still attract a premium and still attract private collectors, unfortunately, new objects, new ceramics, are being placed in salt water for years and years to create the shipwrecked, submerged effect.
Right.
So, you know, raises very interesting questions about what we expect in a museum from an object and about how we attribute value to an object as well.
Yeah.
Do we add the encrustations ourselves or do we remove the encrustations? And what does that say about, you know, the claims we're trying to make on the past?
Mm. I guess the broader question of, you know, object biography, you know, what part of the object's lifespan are we exploring? And, you know, within a museum context, hopefully it's entirety, but that's not always possible. But any alteration to the surface, of course, is affecting the overall story of the object. It's not just as it was when it was created in the 3rd century BC. It's interesting that it has a lot of parallels in terms of mass production, relatively utilitarian vessels. I know that some from the shipwreck have been decorated, but the amphora generally weren't. Some cases they were.
Mm.
That real functionality, that expression of Roman and earlier Greek trade networks, high-level production and very systematic processes of international trade, reflecting everything as well. Do you see that when you look at an object like this, those parallels?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, on the Bluetong shipwreck, they did have these storage containers and they were used to hold the small bowls that I was talking about.
Yeah.
And they were coiled helically inside the large storage jars and packed with like straw or mung bean. I call it like an organic bubble wrap.
Yeah.
And this very sophisticated packing technique allowed them to put as many objects as possible on the ship.
Yep.
And it also protected the objects when the ship was wrecked. So it means that those bowls that are inside the large storage jars are very well protected. They're in good condition and they're not broken compared to the ones that weren't packed inside the storage jars.
Right.
And then, you know,
and that's the reason why they've attracted such high value was because they were in such good condition.
Well, there's a range. Some of them were in great condition, some were not in such great condition. But it got me thinking about shipping containers and containerized shipping in antiquity and thinking about today and the prominence of the shipping crate. And there is this fantastic book called The Box by Mark Levinson, and it looks at how shipping containers have changed the economic landscape of the global economy because they're intermodal, they're highly efficient, they're packable.
Yes.
So it's so,
and they're reusable.
Yes, they're reusable, exactly. So we see early example of that with the amphora here and with the storage jars on the Bluetong shipwreck. Of course, in antiquity, they were ceramic, but they were using them in such a sophisticated way to transport as many objects as efficient a manner as possible.
Yeah. And, of course, in terms of the Mediterranean amphora, the pointed base that often confuses people in terms of, well, how does it sit on the hull? It's got this pointy bit, but the whole design is actually perfect in terms of packing four at the bottom and then the fifth one with the base sitting through in the centre. And it's really a masterpiece of design in terms of the way that they're being handled.
Mm.
The amphora famously was once described as the jerry can of antiquity, and again, very much within a European and Mediterranean context. But you talked about those packing containers. Is there a Southeast Asian equivalent of something for carrying liquid and semi-liquid commodities?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There were these storage jars of varying sizes, if I'm thinking about the Bluetong shipwreck, and many of them have survived the wrecking event.
Mm.
And they were used to transport everything from, you know, water and liquid. They also found very small, a very small, beautiful blue glass bottle, probably from the Middle East, used for possibly makeup or medicine.
Yep.
And they found that as part of this shipwreck discovery as well, which reminds us that there were, across the world, people were experimenting with how to transport, not across the land, but across the ocean.
And also indicative that the sailors have done that voyage before.
Yeah.
Probably many times before.
Yes, and, you know, they did construct a replica boat called the Jewel of Muscat based on the archaeological evidence found at the Bluetong site, and they sailed it from Oman to Singapore in 2010. And I mentioned it was a stitched, sewn hull vessel, and they rendered the inside with goat fat, and apparently it just absolutely stank. So the conditions weren't always, you know, smooth sailing. Yes. They encountered a storm. They lost their mast. It was difficult to find a tree long enough to replace the mast. So these were very difficult and challenging voyages with precious cargo worth a lot of money.
Yes.
So, you know, a shipwreck was a big loss
for
the merchants, for the purchasers, and, of course, for the crew who, you know, no human remains were found on the shipwreck that I looked at. But, of course, these were dangerous journeys.
Yes, yes, very much so. So what drew you to choose this particular object?
Yeah, so I've written this book, and it was one of those things where at the end of the book when it came out, I realised I'd left a whole section out. And I suppose that is a process of developing as a scholar, right?
Yeah.
Something you publish a year ago, you know, your thinking moves on or develops.
You never reread your own work, do
right.
you?
So what I realised I left out of my book and what I'm really intrigued with is the period between when the ship was wrecked in the early 9th century and when it was discovered in 1998. So about 1,100 years when the objects were underwater.
So the greatest lifespan
the
of the
longest part
story.
Of the story. Yeah. And, you know, in privileging the wrecking and the discovery and the controversy, what I realised is I had really privileged humans in the story. But humans are messing up the world, and our ocean is warming, rising, acidifying. It's full of pollution and plastic. So I wanted to think about this concept of what I call the multi-species shipwreck. And it's been really inspired by work of excellent scholars like Killian Quigley, who was previously at Sydney Uni. And he has developed this idea of the encrusting ocean, where he examines concrescence and wreck mounds. So he looks closely at these submerged, encrusted anthropic objects, especially ceramics, which do so well underwater, and how they're interpreted in terms of what they tell us about human maritime past. So when I first started my research many years ago, I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know what concretion was or concrescence was. So now I know that these are really complex, dense, solid, rock-like lumps that form underwater when elements like sand, sea life, and salt water come together with lime, ceramics, and metals. And Killian describes these concretions, this is a lovely quote, as lively collaborations among sea waters, invertebrates, ocean sediments, and drowned anthropic objects.
Oh, that's amazing.
And he asks a question, you know, he looks specifically at these very beautiful objects like this amphora that are displayed in museums as almost works of art. You know, who is the creator of this work of art? Is it the human who made the object? Is it the person who has put it on a plinth at the museum? Or is it the ocean itself? So thinking about the agency of the ocean and what it is capable of when humans are not part of the, or when humans are removed from the story. This is still a human technology, this amphora, but the ocean has acted on it for 1,000 years, and look at what it has created.
Oh, extraordinary.
Yeah, so stand by for some more thinking around that space.
The next book.
Yes.
You're listening to Object Matters. My guest for this episode is Dr. Natalie Pearson. Natalie, what's the story of this amphora? Where's it from?
So we could say it's from Italy or from the Mediterranean, but I'm going to say that this amphora is from the ocean.
Good point.
It's very a human-made object using human technologies to achieve human objectives, so transporting liquid across the sea. And it has spent a significant amount of time underwater. I don't know how long, but at least, you know, hundreds of years by the look of it, in the process of which it has become encrusted with these oyster shells and marine matter. So its story is one of human technology in its creation and human discovery, which is how it came to be here in the museum. And in between is this long period of time where it was not part of human worlds and instead part of other processes and entanglements in the ocean.
That's great. We've talked before, it was made in the 2nd century BCE. How did it get to Sydney?
Well, it's part of the Nicholson collection, donated by Sir Charles Nicholson in 1860, I believe. And what's really interesting here is, in, you know, thinking about its journey from the ocean to the museum is what its age, you know, what its condition tells us about the ability of the ocean to protect and preserve objects, especially ceramics. They can survive remarkably well in the right conditions, the cool waters, low salinity and no oxygen. And it's when humans come and disturb the site and interfere that you start to see more destruction and decay and degradation.
Yeah.
But what really speaks to me here is that ability of the ocean to protect it for so long before it came to be part of Charles Nicholson's collection and then the Nicholson collection at the university.
It's interesting you say that too, because it's similar to terrestrial archaeology in many ways, that the object under the ground or under the sea develops a degree of chemical stability that's interrupted by the process of either excavating it out of the ground or, in the case of something like this, or in the case of the shipwreck, taking it to the surface.
Well, thinking about the ship that probably carried this would have been a timber ship, and those timber ships are very vulnerable to mollusks, shipworms, and these mollusks have a great time when a ship goes down because they get their breakfast, lunch and dinner from the ship's timbers.
Yes.
So the wreck is being destroyed, but the shipworms are benefiting. So it's very interesting to ask these questions about flourishing and decay and relationships between species and objects in the ocean.
Mm. I mean, I recall a site that I've dived on off the coast of Cyprus, in which the shipwreck has gone down. The material, including amphora that's been scattered across the surface, has become encrusted. And what subsequently happened is that the seabed beneath has eroded away. So it's actually possible to swim through this cave, look up at the amphora, and then swim out the other side, which is an extraordinary experience, but really indicative of, A, the length of time it's been underwater, but also how, once you've got that stability, in the case of something like this, that is encrustation, all sorts of other things can happen around, but it's not going anywhere.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. This particular amphora is currently on display as part of our Roman Spectra's exhibition. You've obviously seen it a few different times, and when it used to be on display in the old Nicholson space, have you found that the way that you connect with the object has changed over the time that you've first seen it through to now?
I really love the position of this object because I see it every time I go to the museum. Every time I go to the museum, I also go to the cafe for a coffee or coffee or a glass of wine. Yes. And the amphora is just near the entrance to the cafe, so it's really prominent. And I love how prominent it is at the within the exhibition.
It's incredibly appropriate that a wine-carrying vessel is located next to the place in the museum where you can get a glass of wine.
So, you know, I think for me it represents my growing, developing thinking around what happens with shipwrecks when they're underwater and how humans make use of them, use them as resources, and how there might be other ways of thinking about shipwrecks and the objects that they carry. So, you know, I love how prominent this is. It reminds me every time I go to the museum of the agency of the ocean and of the sort of incredible interactions that happen between not just the marine ecosystems and the coral and the critters, but also how that is shaped by the salt and the temperature and all these other strange inanimate things that we may not be paying attention to.
Mm.
And my thinking around that is continuing to develop, so I'm grateful to it for the little reminder every time I go to the museum.
The question everyone who appears on Object Matters gets asked is this one: if you could choose one single word to describe the object or your connection to the object, what word would that be?
Muse. Shipwrecks and submerged anthropic objects really give me so much to think about. They're potent departure points for thinking about mobility and trade and history, of course, but they also invite me to think about the human influence on the ocean and how the oceans influence us and what might happen for the better, if we try to decenter ourselves from the picture and instead allow these other stories, these more than human stories, to emerge.
Mm.
So they are really potent muses for me, thinking about objects that have spent a lot of time underwater and how they have changed and affected change.
Visitors to the Chow Chak Wing Museum on their way to the cafe, we'll be walking past it. When they stop to have a look after listening to this, what would you like listeners to think about?
Look, I'd really like them to think about the strange agency of the ocean.
Mm.
It's 70% of the planet, and if we're not thinking about the ocean, we're missing a huge part of the story. So it's not just about the animals and the marine life in the ocean, although they're absolutely critical as but all the inanimate matter like salinity, thermal vents, all the weird things that go on at the bottom of the seabed, the tides, all these interactions and entanglements that are co-creating and world-making underwater.
Yeah, and human history has always been about engagement with the sea.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, look, Craig, thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Thank you. It's been amazing. When you first suggested the object, I was thinking, what? But to, exactly what we want the museum to be, exactly what you're doing with the centre, this idea of how do we see one thing through the lens of another. So this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you.
I really appreciate it. It's been great to think about the ocean and Chow Chak Wing Museum's incredible collection. Thank you.
Thank you, Natalie. Object Matters is recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We wish to pay our respect to the traditional custodians of the land, sea and water, and to acknowledge the ongoing connections with those environments held by the Gadigal people.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.